Kahanafeld's webinar, Back to Business. My name is Carl Katz. I'm a partner at Kahanafeld, and I am the moderator for today's webinar. If you want to send me a message, you can find me in the chat feature under moderator. Before we get too far along, I want to go over a couple of protocols. Everyone will be on mute, and we have also turned off your videos. You should still be able to see the panelists. And if you want to speak, we should be able to unmute your microphone. Our panelists are each going to present on key questions in employment law and business law brought by COVID-19. And when they're done, we'll have some questions that we will address that have been sent in by some of you via email. And then we'll have a chance to ask other questions that you may have. We have a lot of attendees. I'm really glad to see that. So if you have a question, please identify yourself by sending a message to moderator in the chat feature, and I will either call on you, or if you don't want me to call on you, but you would like to submit a question and you haven't already done so, then submit the question to moderator and I'll read it on your behalf. A couple of other notes. We are providing general observation and guidance. This is not legal advice, and there's no attorney-client relationship established by this webinar. If you do have a question that is specific to your business, I want to let you know we are providing, Kahanafeld is providing 1 hour pro bono assistance to businesses for questions related to COVID-19. I'll be posting the email address where you can send those questions on the chat feature shortly. And also to let you know this is being recorded. So after the session is done, we will have this up on our website. You can come back and refer to it or refer your friends to it. All right, you ready to go? Good. Our panels today are Ron Brand, who is a partner with Kahanafeld's Employment Litigation Section. Ron is also the former chair of the OC Bar Association's Labor and Employment Section. We also have Samuel Yu, a partner with Kahanafeld's Business and Commercial Litigation Team. Samuel has been has over a decade of business litigation experience, and he serves as secretary for the OC Korean American Bar Association. We also have Ben Smith, who was helping us moderate and host the webinar today. Both Ron and Sam are going to start with their own presentations, and then we'll get into some questions. So Ron, let's begin with you.
Great. Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody, for taking the time out of your day to attend the webinar. There's a lot to go over. I've seen some checklists that are 15, 20 pages long from law firms and other consultants. So I'm only going to spend a few minutes to go over what I feel are kind of the major points go over today. And we want to leave enough time for people to ask questions. So I'm basically going to cover 6 major points, the most relevant topics that you need to be aware of as you reopen your businesses. The first one, and one of the most important ones, is workplace safety. Employers have an obligation to maintain a safe work environment for its employees. And this is even more important now that businesses start to reopen and employees are going to start coming back to the workplace. So some of the things you can do to maintain a safe workplace as much as possible, because we know that you can't maintain a workplace that's 100% safe, but you can take reasonable practical steps to maintain a safe workplace. One is you want to make sure that you comply with all federal, state, and local COVID-19 directives from the CDC, from OSHA, and Cal OSHA. You want to make sure that you develop social distancing plans, meaning you want to modify the workplace to maintain at least a 6-foot difference. You want to limit in-person interactions and physical contact as much as possible. You want to train employees as much as possible on maintaining these social distancing policies and protocols. And to the extent feasible, reduce the number of employees that are present in the workplace at any one time. Another thing you want to do is implement a screening protocol in compliance with state and federal laws. The EEOC has stated that it is permissible to take the temperature of employees when they come back to work, but there are a whole host of issues that come out of testing employees' temperature. You got to make sure that the employees who are doing the testing have the proper protective equipment, that they know how to take the temperature, that the employees who are waiting in line to get their temperature tested are paid for that time, because it is considered waiting time. It's considered compensable time. So you have to make sure that if you're going to test employees for their temperature, you do so in a safe and effective manner. Another thing you want to consider is requiring employees to wear appropriate personal protective equipment, such as masks and gloves. Another thing you want to do is clean and disinfect the office space as much as possible. And if it becomes possible in the future, you want to possibly test your employees for COVID-19. And as an employer, you are allowed to test for COVID-19 if you can get your hands on a test. I know they come by, and a lot of the tests are not very reliable. So that's the first thing you want to do. The second thing you want to do, they want to consider, is how are you going to recall your employees who are on a leave of absence or on furlough? You want to phase employees returning to work. You want to make sure that you do not use any seniority, any discriminatory factors. So you want to make sure you use like seniority or non-discriminatory factors for selecting employees who are going to be returning to work. You want to maybe consider schedule changes to provide the greatest protection to workers. You want to create a plan for employees in high-risk categories for infection to return to work. Maybe you consider allowing them to continue to work from home. And you also want to deal with how are you going to determine how to handle employees who are unable or unwilling to return to work. Finally, you want to notify the California EDD of employees who have been recalled to work. This is a state requirement, and it will help to save on unemployment taxes for those who choose not to return to work. The third bucket is remote work. You know, now that employees have been working from home, a lot of them will want to continue to working from home. Now, you are not necessarily required to keep them working from home, but you want to, on a case-by-case basis, determine whether or not it makes sense to keep certain employees working from home. If they can work productively and effectively, maybe it makes sense to keep certain employees working from home. Maybe you stagger weeks in office and at home among team members so that some employees come to work for 1 week and other employees work at home and vice versa. Communications, that's another bucket. You want to make sure that you communicate effectively with your employees about what to do if they're sick, about your physical distancing policies, what your workplace safety and disinfection protocols are going to be, have a exposure response communication ready to go, and if any affected employees or customers are somehow, they either get COVID-19 or they are possibly infected. So you want to make sure that you have adequate and appropriate communications with your employees so that your employees know what is expected of them and that the employers know what is expected of them. Now, another thing you need to be concerned about is dealing with future labor and employment litigation. I believe there's going to be an avalanche of labor and employment related claims and litigation. And there's a whole host of them. I'm just briefly going to go over them. You can anticipate that workers' compensation claims are going to increase. You're going to anticipate that some individuals may try to go outside of the workers' compensation system and file separate lawsuits for gross negligence, saying that you do not maintain a safe work environment. There are going to be wage and hour claims dealing with employees who maybe were non-exempt and they say they weren't paid all of their hours that they worked from home because adequate time cards were not utilized. You're going to have to deal with employees who are claiming that they are not being, that they were not reimbursed for all the expenses they incurred working at home. You're going to get claims from employees who say that they weren't compensated for the time they had to take on and off personal equipment or the time that they spent waiting in line to get tested for their temperature. So those are kind of the wage and hour claims you're going to have to be aware of. Other claims are going to be based on violations of the Family First Coronavirus Response Act, that either they were not given paid sick leave, paid emergency sick leave, or paid family leave, or that they were retaliated against for either taking such leave or requesting such leave. In fact, there's a lawsuit pending now in Philadelphia, Stephanie Jones versus Eastern Airlines, that involves both interference and retaliation claims under the FFCRA. So I believe there's going to be an avalanche of those types of claims. You also have to be aware of other common law statutory discrimination, harassment, and retaliation claims. There has been an uptick in claims of harassment based upon being in a certain ethnicity or national origin. The FBI has reported that Chinese and Asian Americans are experiencing increased hate crimes, and also that Chinese and Asian Americans are experiencing increased harassment at the workplace. There are going to be claims based on violations of the General Duty Clause of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. And that General Duty Clause says that employers have to furnish a workplace that is free from recognized hazards that are likely to cause death or serious physical harm. And then there could be invasion of privacy claims as well. So those are kind of the main labor and employment cases that I see coming in the pipeline and that employers need to be concerned about. So what can employers do to mitigate these future labor and employment litigation claims? Well, there are several things you can do. One, you want to make sure that you comply with all current guidelines from the leading health authorities to keep the workplace as safe as possible. And I discussed that a little earlier. So follow CDC guidelines, follow Cal OSHA guidelines, and follow OSHA guidelines as much as reasonably possible. I understand that there may be times that you cannot comply with certain guidelines, or certain guidelines may not be applicable to your industry, but you need to do everything humanly possible to follow the current guidelines from the leading health authorities. You want to designate somebody in your office who is the quote-unquote expert with respect to the various labor and employment issues arising out of COVID-19. This will ensure that any response to any type of an issue that comes up with respect to COVID-19 will be dealt consistently and that the proper review has been conducted. Another thing you want to do is carefully review your existing insurance policies. See if you're covered by, see if you have EPLI, Employment Practices Liability Insurance. And if you don't, you should seriously consider getting such coverage. You want to make sure that your employees are complying with existing anti-discrimination, anti-retaliation, and anti-harassment policies, and that you enforce such policies consistently. Another thing you want to do is send a written memo to all of your employees stating that blaming or harassing any ethnic or national origin group due to COVID-19 violates workplace policies, is not tolerated, and could be grounds for disciplinary action. You want to train your employees regarding their COVID-19 policies, benefits, procedures, processes. You also want to review all of your existing policies that will be impacted by the lifting of the workplace restrictions and all the different COVID-19 directives to make sure that they're in compliance with the law, like paid leave policies, attendance policies, time off requests, meal and rest break policies, travel policies. There are dozens of different policies that you're going to want to review and update as necessary to take into account all the COVID-19 legal issues that are going to arise. So those are kind of the six buckets of labor and employment issues that you need to be concerned about going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. That's some great tips in there. We'll be diving into some of those a little bit more shortly. I want to let everybody know as well that we will be consolidating some of these best tips into a PDF for you that we expect to send out to you tomorrow. So Sam, outside of employment issues, what are some of the main concerns from a business operations perspective?
Thank you, Carl. There's three topics that I thought can be very helpful to businesses as they begin opening up. Ron touched on some of the employment issues. Some of these are interrelated with employment, but not necessarily. The first topic that I kind of wanted to address was trade secret, non-competition, and duty of loyalty issues that you would have with current and returning employees, terminated employees, and then also newly hired employees. For current and returning employees, it's very important that your company circulate a comprehensive remote work policy that addresses concerns about maintaining and safeguarding your company's trade secrets and confidential information, such as customer lists, proprietary forms, sensitive financial information, and the like. And for employees who are working remotely, you need to ensure that there's proper infrastructure in place as far as the tools that they need to perform and provide a work policy regarding expectations, reimbursements, et cetera, so that they can ensure the safeguard of the company's trade secrets and proprietary information. The concern there is just that You know, when you have a lot of employees that are working remotely, you don't have as much control over the technology that they're using. And so it's important that you have a policy in place to kind of ensure the safeguard and protect really valuable information, and that competitors won't take advantage of the situation and misappropriate trade secrets. As for terminated employees, it's important that you ensure that any employees who have been let go return all company-issued devices and ensure that confidential information and company trade secrets are returned. If any confidential or trade secret information is on the employee's personal devices, you should have a protocol to ensure that all the trade secret and protected information is removed. As for newly hired employees, you kind of have the reverse, where you know you should be concerned about potential trade secrets that they may be bringing over to your company that might later on result in a trade secret misappropriation lawsuit from your competitor. So it's important that you educate new employees about the company's policy regarding trade secret and confidential information, and ensure that they basically purge themselves of all materials from their former employees, former employers that can be considered a trade secret. Otherwise, you might be inviting yourself to a lawsuit that could be very detrimental. The second issue that has come up is communications with third parties. Ron did a phenomenal job in addressing the safety concerns as far as employees are concerned, but there's also concerns for a safe environment for those that would come onto your facilities that are not necessarily employed by you. So it's important that you establish and communicate clear protocol for access to the workplace, as well as the new rules that impact them. And you need to review and amend agreements with vendors, suppliers, cleaning services, and the like, and ensure that they will agree to comply with local, state, and federal law. And the third issue is insurance coverage. Ron touched on getting EPLI policies. And this is going to be a field that's going to be heavily litigated. There's already lawsuits that are pending. One was filed by the famous chef Thomas Keller against Scottsdale. And our suggestion to our clients is that if you have any questions about whether a policy applies or not, go ahead and tender. Even if you have doubts as to whether the policy applies, the worst case scenario is the insurance carrier will deny coverage, but they'll have an obligation to provide you with a coverage letter that details the rationale for the denial, and then you can kind of make a determination whether you want to escalate it and pursue other recourses. And the question really depends on what type of loss are you dealing with. So there's a couple of insurance policies that have come up pretty frequently that deal with COVID-19. One is event cancellation insurance. Businesses that schedule large meetings and events purchase event cancellation insurance to protect against potential losses caused by needing to cancel, postpone, or cut short an event, or due to reduced attendance as a result of a covered event. However, many standard policies include infectious and communicable disease exclusions, which may preclude coverage. And in my research, it seems that a lot of these exclusions came up as insurance carriers were dealing with the SARS outbreak. They took a heavy loss because of the number of claims that were raised. And so they've been savvy in adding additional exclusions so that they won't be overstretched in terms of their coverage. Another type of insurance that has come up is travel insurance. Most travel protection plans actually do not cover losses caused by events or that were known or foreseeable at the time of the protection plan was purchased. They also typically do not specifically cover losses caused by an epidemic. So as a result, if there were travel plans that were made mid to late January, chances are there might not be coverage, but that's also potentially coverage that's available. Another one is business interruption policy. This is typically triggered when a policyholder sustains direct physical loss or damage to insured property because of a covered peril. Many commercial property policies also include an extension for contingent business interruption insurance, which is triggered by a direct physical loss of or damage to the insured property of a customer or supplier. But the bottom line is there's no uniform jurisdiction when it comes to this policy. There's no uniform rule. And the bottom line is, you know, there's no, it's going to be case to case on whether there has been a sufficient physical loss or damage to an insured property that would trigger business interruption insurance. And several courts have determined that structural damage to insured property is not necessarily required. Instead, it can be sufficient if contamination or conditions such as gases or bacteria render property temporarily or permanently unusable or uninhabitable. There's also commercial general liability insurance. This is potential coverage for claims by guests or customers who claim they acquired the coronavirus because the business allegedly failed to exercise reasonable care in reducing the chances of exposure to coronavirus, or allegedly, you know, failing to adequately warn about the risk of exposure. So again, I think it's important that you, you know, follow the advice that Ron gave in terms of having a policy in place regarding the safety of your workplace, not just for your employees, but also for guests and customers. And then there's two other policies that I just kind of want to briefly touch on, and that's errors and omissions and directors and officers liability insurance. I think this would mainly apply to those that are in the healthcare industry. E&O coverage would protect against claims and damages because of bodily injury. There may be coverage of a patient or other guest to a medical office or hospital or to claim they acquired the coronavirus as a result of visiting the medical office or hospital. As for the D&O, the business or its officers or directors could face claims from third parties based on allegations that the business was negligent or failed to take appropriate measures to respond to the coronavirus outbreak. So most D&O policies contain exclusions related to bodily injury, but the exclusions are not typically uniform and are typically given strict and narrow construction. So, you know, long story short, every policy is going to be a little bit different. And so a lot of the issues on whether the coverage would apply or not, it's going to depend on the language of the policy. But I would just refer back to our to my first point, which is tender early, tender as soon as possible. Worst case scenario, you'll get a coverage letter that explains the rationale. And with that, I'll turn it back to Carl.
Sam, thank you very much for that overview of business issues. We've got a number of questions that have come in. Let me start posing some of them. And I think this one might be for Ron. But Ron, when my business reopens and an employee might not want to come back to work or come back from working at home, what are my options?
Yeah, that's a very common question I get asked. Now, we have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Generally speaking, employees cannot refuse to come to work because they are afraid that they might contract COVID-19. They have to show that there is an imminent threat to either death or harm, so which is very difficult to prove with respect to COVID-19. If an employee refuses to come to work, you need to talk with the employee, find out the reason why, and see if maybe teleworking is an option. If it's not an option and the employee needs to come back to work, you could potentially take the step of terminating the employee if the employee refuses to come back to work. But you still need to tread very carefully. You have to take it on a case-by-case basis because there could be many reasons why an employee refuses to come back to work. And after you figure out what the reasons are and review them, then you could make an appropriate decision. But I recommend to always err on the side of caution in the beginning before you make any drastic move to terminate an employee who refuses to come back to work.
If an employee doesn't want to come back but wants to take PTO or vacation time instead, am I required to let them?
Well, again, it's going to depend on the facts of each situation, and I know that's a typical attorney response, but it does really depend upon the facts of each particular situation. If the employee has a PTO or vacation pay left in the bank, and you have asked the employees to come back to work, and this particular employee wants to use the PTO and vacation pay, then you're going to have to analyze it to see if there's a legitimate, if there's a legitimate need to have the employee come back to work. What will happen if the employee is absent from work? So you don't necessarily have to give the employee the paid time off or vacation pay. But again, you have to evaluate the situation based upon the facts that present themselves at the time.
Okay, sticking with the work from home theme, if work from home is an option for my firm or my business and is not required, is the business legally required to provide reimbursement for internet, cell phone usage, and other business costs that an employee might incur from working from home?
Generally, yes. Under the labor code, employers are required to reimburse to employees any expense that they incur performing work in the course and scope of their employment. So if you require the employee to work from home, then yes, you would have to reimburse the employee reasonable expenses that the employee incurs in performing the job. Now, a situation comes up, you know, the employee has internet anyway, regardless of whether the employee would be working from home, and does the employer have to pay for a certain portion of the internet that's used? You know, if you want to be safe, yes, you know, pay for a certain portion of the internet. If the internet is $100 a month and the employee only, you know, works 20-30% of the time using the internet, then maybe you want to consider reimbursing, you know, 20-30% of that internet fee. But there are other expenses such as cell phone expenses, office equipment. So any type of expense that the employee incurs that's necessitated by, you know, working, then typically the employee needs to be reimbursed those expenses.
Okay. Ron, one more. I have a couple questions related to employees or family members who might be sick with COVID. What if an employee is sick or if an employee's family member is sick, what are my obligations to have that, to let that employee have leave?
Well, yeah, so it depends what the reasons are. And I assume the question is maybe paid emergency leave under the FFCRA. In that situation, if the employee needs to stay home to care for the family member, then emergency paid sick leave would likely apply, assuming the company has less than 500 employees and assuming that employee worked there for at least 30 days. So if the employee is directed to remain at home by a healthcare provider because the healthcare provider is concerned that the employee may have been infected by the family member, then the emergency paid sick leave would apply.
Okay. And if an employee is sick or a family member is sick, what can a business owner tell the other employees in that scenario?
Yeah, that's a very good question. If a current employee has been diagnosed with COVID-19 and that employee has been at the workplace, then you need to find out from that employee everybody that employee has been in contact with and every part of the office that employee has been at, because you need to advise the other potentially infected employees that there was an infection, that somebody at work became infected, and that we maybe have to deal with those employees who may be infected. You cannot tell the other employees of the identity of the employee that was infected because that would violate the privacy rights of that employee. But you can certainly, and I say you must tell other employees that another employee has been infected with COVID-19 and we need to take appropriate measures to protect the employees and protect the workplace.
Okay, so we have to tell employees, but we can't tell them who it is that we're talking about.
Correct, because the individual who's infected has a right to privacy in his or her medical information. That's covered under HIPAA guidelines. And so if an employer discloses the name of the infected employee, the employer would be open up to invasion of privacy claims and possibly a violation of HIPAA.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ron. Sam, I have a couple questions for you. Are my contracts, whether they're with vendors or customers, are they enforceable either by me or them?
I guess it really depends on the language of the contract. That is a question that I've been getting a lot from a lot of my clients, especially on the business litigation side. The popular word that's been going around or phrase is force majeure clauses. And there's a question of whether it can be used to get out of performing on a contract. And for those who don't know, force majeure clauses, it's basically an excuse for performance due to unforeseen events and acts of God. You know, based on the plain language of that, you might think that it should cover COVID-19, but that's also still open to debate because, you know, this is not something that is provided at common law. So, you know, for instance, in California, if a contract doesn't have a force majeure provision, it wouldn't be read into the contract. So it really depends on what the specific language of that contract is. There are some contracts that provide, that specifically mention infectious diseases. There's others, you know, that phrase it as an epidemic. There's those that don't have it. And there's also, in certain contracts that I've seen, there's provisions that set forth what the remedy would be in such an event. I saw one contract where it said, you know, both parties would be excused from performance during that time period. However, the contract period would be extended a reciprocal length. So it really depends. You know, the tips that I would give is one, review the contract. Two, ensure that any notice requirements are met. And number three, open the lines of communication to mitigate potential losses. Even if you have a right to invoke it, it always makes sense to keep the lines of communication open. And even if you have the right, sometimes it doesn't make sense on a business sense to invoke that right. Number four, evaluate whether one party's notice of invoking the force majeure clause can trigger a force majeure event downstream. So for instance, if you get a notice from, you know, from a vendor, you know, think about the ramifications that would have down the stream, including to your customers. And then number five, keep up to date on governmental restrictions and announcements, which may impact the contractual commitments. And so for people who don't have a force majeure clause in your contract, there could potentially be other avenues of relief. One is that common law, you know, California doesn't read into a force majeure provision in the contracts, but it does provide some affirmative defenses that may also apply, including impossibility, impracticability, and frustration of purpose. But something to keep in mind is whichever party is trying to be excused from performance, they're the ones that have the burden of proof to show that, but for this event, it could have performed on the contract. The UCC is also something that's available that could provide statutory relief for the sale of goods that are governed by the UCC. UCC section 2-615 excuses performance of a party's obligations when it becomes impracticable due to unforeseen supervening events that are not within a party's control. So long story short, it's going to depend on the case, it's going to depend on the language of the contract. But you know, if you're the party that wants to enforce the terms of the contract, and you see a force majeure clause, don't think that automatically you're out of luck. You know, the burden's going to be on the other side to prove that they could have performed but for this event.
Okay. Hey, Carl.
Sam.
I want to go over one thing from the CDC because that relates to the questions that you asked previously. The CDC has issued a guidance on businesses who want to reopen, and they've provided a very nifty chart. I'll just show it to you real quick, and we can provide it to you. Basically, this chart, it first asks three questions, and then from there, it goes into other questions, and if you answer yes to all of the questions, then it says you can open, but you need to monitor COVID-19 in the area and be prepared to close quickly if needed. I'll send this chart to you, and I recommend to all my clients. This is one of the best charts, I think, to follow because it encompasses everything that I've talked about earlier in terms of maintaining a safe and healthy workplace. And we can send that CDC guidance to you after the seminar or the webinar.
So that kind of leads to like a very general question I've been wondering about personally. We're seeing states react differently. We see the federal government giving mixed messages. We see the county, Orange County, giving messages that are confusing and vague as they relate to the state's message. What are we supposed to follow? Like, what is the, are we allowed to open coming up? Are we not supposed to open coming up? can the state, does it have the right to close our businesses? Or is this all make it up as we go along?
Well, unfortunately, there are very few precedents for the sort of widespread crackdown on the public as we are seeing now. So this is kind of new territory for everybody. However, under the United States Constitution, under the 10th Amendment, local and state authorities do have the power to enact public health measures that the state and local governments deem necessary. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a number of cases, have protected the state's rights to impose isolation or quarantine orders, to require mandatory vaccinations, and courts have continued to enforce such authority over the years. But of course, there's a limit to the authority. You know, officials cannot push discriminatory or arbitrary policies. But the problem is, at the end of the day, the enforceability of these various stay-at-home orders are only going to be determined to the extent that officials decide to enforce them. And so far, you know, usually most officials have not really enforced these stay-at-home orders. I know here in Orange County, the police enforced the prohibition to go on the beaches, although I just read today that I think San Clemente and Laguna Beach are opening up their beaches. And, you know, the Orange County Public Health Agency that issued the governor's order, the stay-at-home order, they say that even if restrictions are loosened in Orange County, you still need to comply with the state stay-at-home order. So it's kind of a little bit of a mess. I don't know, Sam, do you have any thoughts about that?
No, I think it's really going to depend on the jurisdiction. It's hard to say. I have a friend who's in law enforcement. At least initially when the stay-at-home order was made, his indication was he's heard from the top down that this is not something that's going to be strictly enforced. But I think in terms of the enforcement, it's going to depend, on the jurisdiction. And I think you're spot on. I think, a lot of my colleagues, friends, and even clients, they had questions about the constitutionality of some of these restrictions that are infringing on our liberties. But the bottom line is that when there's a public health and safety issue in place, there is precedent to allow, some liberties to be somewhat constrained. So it's tough. I mean, I can understand from a business owner's perspective, they want to, their livelihood is at stake. They want to, get back to business. I think there is, you can only really check with the local authorities in terms of, what can be permitted.
Yeah, I think when it comes to reopening right now, the train is out of the station. You're going to start seeing more and more jurisdictions, both state, county, and local, opening up to different degrees. So I think it's inevitable at this point. It's kind of like a snowball, right? It starts rolling down the hill. You can't stop it. And then we'll see what happens in several weeks from now if there is a spike in infections and deaths. So we'll see if the reopening was appropriate.
And I think the bottom line is there's not going to be a clear-cut answer on this because we are really dealing with unprecedented times. So there's not an exact fact pattern that we can point to. Even if there are some things that we believe the authorities are doing incorrectly, to litigate this stuff out, it's going to take a while. I know there are some jurisdictions that have brought lawsuits against, the California state government for some of its, more restricted measures. But, those things are going to be, it's going to be a while until we get an answer from the courts.
All right, we're getting a bunch of questions, getting down to brass tacks. Sam, business is having trouble paying its lease. What are its options? I heard that residents don't have to pay rent for 3 months. Is that the same case with business leases?
There's been a little confusion about this. As far as the executive order that was issued by Governor Gavin Newsom, that only applied for residential leases. However, the California Judicial Council and many local authorities, they've expanded these protections to commercial tenants as well. The California Judicial Council on April 6th of 2020 placed a hold on basically all eviction cases within the state. and that applied both to commercial and residential. Basically, it was a hold on unlawful detainer actions for a period of 90 days, and that was for existing unlawful detainer actions. There was also a suspension of the issuance of a summons and unlawful detainer unless the court found that there is a health and safety reason for the eviction. And so this basically meant that pretty much new unlawful detainer cases cannot be filed in most circumstances. There was also the prevention of any entries of default or default judgments in pending unlawful detainer cases unless the court found that there was a health and safety reason and the defendant has not appeared. For unlawful detainer trials, they can't be set no earlier than 60 days after the request for trial, again, unless there's a health and safety reason. And all trials on calendar as of April 1st were continued for at least 60 days. There's also local governments, local authorities that have broadened the protection as far as evictions were concerned. LA County Board of Supervisors, they issued an executive order on April 14th. As far as its application for commercial business owners, it applied retroactively to March 4th. It banned evictions for non-payment of rent if a tenant can show that they were financially impacted by the health emergency. Renters would have 12 months after the moratorium period ended to pay back any back rent. And landlords were precluded from imposing any pass-through or interest charges or late fees for unpaid rent during the moratorium period. Tenants were also permitted to provide self-certification for their inability to pay rent, and landlords are required to accept this as sufficient notice. Orange County, based on what I could tell and based on my research, I couldn't find something that comprehensive that applied across the entire county, but I know that there are local, on the city level, I know that there were some orders passed. For instance, I had a client in Buena Park that operates a children's fitness center. And I've discovered that the Buena Park City Council adopted a law prohibiting evictions for tenants of both residential and commercial properties. And it also precluded the assessment of late fees and penalties. So to answer your question, the likelihood that there are some protections even for commercial tenants is pretty likely. But you'll just have to check your local local policies and see if there's an order that provides that protection.
Okay. Ron, following up with your comments earlier about testing, can you clarify, can you require an employee with symptoms or fever to take the test, or is the test optional? Coming to the office and we have tested.
Are you talking about the COVID-19 test or the temperature test?
How about either one?
Yeah, so the EEOC has stated that you can require employees to take the test, especially if they're exhibiting symptoms. Now, the EEOC has said that even if an employee doesn't exhibit symptoms, you can test the temperature of all employees coming to the office, as long as you apply the test evenly and it's non-discriminatory, right? You don't just test, you test all women but no men, right? So as long as you apply the policy evenly, you can require employees submit to temperature testing and also to COVID-19 testing.
And what if they don't want to take it? What's my recourse?
Well, that's a good question. I would certainly send them home and then sit down with your labor and employment attorney and discuss what's the best way to get rid of this person. I don't necessarily think that person should be terminated right away. I think there should be steps taken beforehand to try to ascertain why the person is refusing to take the test, explaining to the person that this is done for not only the health and safety of the other employees, but also his health and safety, and try to ascertain what is exactly going on there. And then once you receive answers to those questions, you make a decision whether to maybe place the employee on a leave of absence or terminate the employee.
So clarifying one of your other comments too about employers carrying the burden of costs for employees that are working at home. What if an employee has a workstation that's not portable at their office, but we have to work from home? Do I, as a business, have to now buy portable computers or arrange to move all of their workstations from the office to their home?
I don't think you have to move the workstations, but if the job of the employee requires the use of a computer and you are requiring the employee to work from home because of the stay-at-home orders, then yes, you would need to either provide the employee with a computer or reimburse the employee for the computer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Here's one very specific to the healthcare sector. In the healthcare setting, we are currently permitting high-risk staff members to perform tasks with reduced exposure. If they refuse these low-risk tasks and want to participate in direct patient care and increase their exposure, is it a good idea to have a liability form, have these higher-risk staff members sign them to protect ourselves?
Well, number one, I would not allow that individual to perform those high-risk tasks, participate in direct patient care, unless it's something that is, you know, required by any, you know, state, federal, local, you know, healthcare laws. But I don't know if I would direct an individual to participate in direct patient care and increase their exposure, unless it's something that is part of the duties of the employee. And in terms of signing a liability form, you can have them sign the form, but I doubt that it would be enforceable, because as the employer, you have the obligation to maintain a safe and healthy work environment, and you really can't put that onus on the employee. So I don't think signing a liability form like that would be enforceable.
If an employee does get sick, am I, as a business owner, covered by workers' comp?
Right. So generally speaking, workers' comp covers workplace injuries. So then the question arises whether contracting COVID-19 is a workplace injury. The employee is going to have to prove that he or she contracted COVID-19 at work as opposed to at the grocery store or going to the bank. So I think it's going to be difficult for many employees to do so, not impossible. And so if it is a workplace injury, then the workers' compensation system would cover that particular injury. If the employee is claiming that the employer was negligent, did not maintain a safe and healthy work environment, and was grossly negligent, that could fall outside of the workers' compensation system and could be in state court. In fact, I was just reading an article today that some employees have filed a lawsuit in court seeking an injunction to force their employer to provide them with certain health and safety measures. And I think it was just filed. And I don't know if the court has issued any type of injunction yet, but that is kind of a unique lawsuit. I've never seen that one before.
Okay. So you guys are talking a lot about employees and employers. What about a business that deals primarily with independent contractors? What ability do I have as a business owner to enforce these policies in dealing with independent contractors?
Sam, do you want to take that one?
When you're talking about policies, what policies are you talking about? Are you talking about for workplace policies?
Then I'll give you this specific one that came from one of the attendees here. They are the owner of a hair salon, and all the stylists are independent contractors. Mm-hmm. How does that business owner enforce these independent contractors who are not employees to abide by best practices?
I would say that the same concerns that anybody would have in that workplace would apply also to independent contractors. I don't know in this particular instance whether there is a independent contractor agreement, but if there is, then I would definitely advise them to make an amendment to update it so that there are that they have an understanding in terms of what safety measures are being placed in that workplace, but also that these independent contractors will abide by it so that it can ensure the safety of its customers.
Yeah, I have two thoughts about that. Number one, I'm not sure that those stylists are independent contractors, especially under the new AB5, the ABC test. My sense is that those individuals would likely be employees. But putting that aside for the moment.
That's another question.
Yeah,
That's another webinar.
Yeah, that's another webinar, right. But for purposes of how do you impose these safety measures on independent contractors, I think that puts the salon in a difficult position, because on the one hand, you don't want to show that you're controlling those individuals because you want to claim that they're independent contractors and you have no control over them. And the more control you have over them by forcing them to comply with certain health and safety measures, you know, the more likely it is that they would be considered employees. On the other hand, if you don't force those safe health and safety measures on the independent contractors, you can open yourself up to liability for customers suing you for not maintaining a health and a healthy and safe work environment. So it is a difficult, you know, kind of rock between the hard place situation.
Good. Thank you, Ron. Thanks, Sam. Sam, what are some business risks that businesses might face having employees work remotely?
Well, I mentioned the earlier concern with the trade secret information. There's also been an uptick on cyber crimes. They're taking advantage of the situation. They understand that a lot of employees are working remotely. And so there's been an uptick in terms of the dissemination of malware and phishing emails that could really cause huge damages to a company. I think one thing that I read was there's a group that's sending out emails that appear to be coming from the World Health Organization, and it's asking for sensitive information. And so they issued a warning and indicated that that they would never ask for your username or password. They would never email you attachments that you never asked for, and to verify with their link, just to confirm any communication that they receive. They would never charge money to apply for a job, register for a conference, or reserve a hotel. And they don't conduct lotteries or offer prizes through email. So this is just something that you definitely want to advise those that are working in your company to be wary of these type of phishing attacks. And so that obviously is one of the dangers when you have a lot of people working from home. So one thing that I would, say is, keep on guard and have your employees verify whoever's sending the email, check. There's a lot of emails that look very similar to one that they would find to be normal, but maybe like a word or two or a letter or two is just off. So just check the sender's email, check any links before clicking on them, and be very cautious whenever a request for personal information is made. And the most important thing is don't feel rushed or feel like you need to do something right away. Chances are that if you get an email that's saying that, time is of the essence, that you need to do this or something drastic is going to happen, most likely this is a scam that they should just be wary of. I would also coordinate with, if you have an IT team in place, make sure that they're also getting information that could attack the entire organization. In terms of cybercrime, I think that's one specific way that you could safeguard your company.
Okay, thank you, Sam. Does anybody else have some questions that they might like to ask? I've received quite a bit through the chat feature.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
You guys talked about insurance policies for that dramatic loss of work, not just due to physical damage. I have a policy, and they specifically write in their exclusionary clause that states they will not pay if the government mandated the closure or if it's due to bacteria or viruses. How enforceable is that? And should I still file a claim?
Is this your RAM? Your RAM?
Yes.
Yeah, I was assuming that was an insurance-related question. I just wasn't sure. I guess the policy, the language existed at the time that you purchased the policy. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so it's not as if they're trying to change the rules on you. This is something that existed long before.
No.
Okay. I go back to my first point. There's no, even despite that exclusion, I don't think there's a harm in tendering that claim. The reason why tendering is important is because if there is any chance that there is a claim that is covered, it'll only be covered from the date that the initial claim was raised to the insurance carrier. And so even if there's a chance that they would reject it, in the off chance that it is covered, you want to do it as soon as possible. And like I said, the only downside is you would get a coverage letter that you know, basically sets forth the rationale. Based on what you're telling me, I think for sure it'll probably be denied. You can expect a denial, and it probably would cite to that. But it'll probably be, it'll be very comprehensive. It'll put all of the other reasons why they would say that the claim is denied. And, you know, depending on the purpose of the policy, I think there are some arguments that you might be able to make, but quite honestly, I would have to see the actual policy to determine, you know, what your chances would be in terms of a, you know, in terms of a bad faith lawsuit or something like that.
What's one of such potential things? Because it's technically government closure and technically not just government closure, but it's government closure due to a pandemic, which is by their clause, it doesn't say natural pandemic. So, I mean, how would you word such a claim? It's probably the...
I'm sorry, is the question how would I have phrased the claim? Or the exemption?
Yeah, how would you phrase the claim to them that, hey, I should get coverage?
Like I said, this is going to be a case-by-case basis. You know, if that is a question that you have, you know, we do have attorneys here that are well-versed in terms of insurance, interpreting insurance policies. I don't know. Maybe there is some other, you know, avenue to get you coverage. I just don't know based on the individual facts and the language that's in the policy to give you an answer on this webinar.
Yeah, I do want to acknowledge it's.
If I can just chime in for a moment, when you tender to insurance, you generally don't want to say too much. You just tender the claim. When they come back with a denial, that's when if you really want to fight it, you need to get good coverage counsel. Our firm doesn't do coverage work specifically because we do a lot of insurance defense work. But as a result, a lot of times our clients need insurance coverage work, and we can recommend a number of very strong coverage attorneys. So if you need that issue addressed, just reach out to us, and we can certainly connect you with coverage attorneys.
Okay. Thank you, Amir. So it's. I just want to acknowledge that it's 2:00. There's a few questions that are still in the pipeline, and as long as Ron and Sam can stay on for at least a little bit, we can continue to answer them. Is that okay with you guys?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So here's one. It's going specific again. If you have some employees who are more vulnerable than others to complications from COVID-19, is it okay to have different rules for different employees on how they return to work? I mean, how do you handle the situation for older employees or those with pre-existing medical conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. You can certainly treat employees who are more at risk than other employees in different ways. So for the employees who are at high risk, you could maybe have them work from home if that's feasible. Or you could have them work at times of the day when there are fewer employees. So yes, absolutely. Not only can you do that, but you should do that. And that's part of the recall procedure where you determine which employees you're going to call back first and why. And as long as you don't use any type of discriminatory factors, and as long as they're legitimate factors because of the medical conditions of the individual, that's certainly, I would say that you need to do that as you recall employees back to the workplace.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. Do you have any other questions right now from our attendees? You can feel free to unmute yourself or pose the question through the chat. Okay, well, in that case, I want to thank Ron and Sam for your insights. I want to thank everybody for attending today and giving us your time. We wish you a safe reopening when that comes. If you have further COVID questions, as a reminder, we are offering 1 hour pro bono advice. Please email to beatcovid19@kahanafeld.com. The address can also be found in our chat feature. Also, we expect by tomorrow that we will have a copy of this recording up on our website. We will send you a link in the morning along with a PDF of some of the key takeaways from today. So as you begin to open up your business, you have those to follow. If you don't see the email by noon tomorrow, please check your junk mail or your spam filters. And thank you all once again for attending and sharing your time with us today. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.